Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
One of the most tragic days in American history took place on November 18th, 1978. Led by cult leader Jim Jones, over 900 people drank poison Kool-Aid to take their own life. 304 of them were children. How could this many people walk down this dark path? And who was the monster leading them? This is True Crimecast.
Welcome to True Crimecast. I'm Jamie, here in studio with John. What's good?
Hey, man. How's it going?
Things are good, man. It's been a good week in the podcast world. We got some new Patreon members you can thank in a minute. We got a review from somebody named Emma in the Netherlands.
Hi, Emma in the Netherlands.
Now, we get several reviews, but this one is unique. Like, we can see all international reviews, but if you just get on iTunes, you can only see the American ones, right?
Right.
So, Emma said she called it comfort crime. And after I read that, that was her title, and she said some really nice words, but that's what we should have called this.
Comfort crime. That's a very interesting title. I think we might have to change the name of the show.
To be clear, we named this show True Crime Cast because we thought if somebody Googles True Crime Podcast, that True Crime Cast might come up.
Yeah. I don't know that that's working out the way we hoped it would, but we're doing great nonetheless.
We are. People are donating on Patreon. Who do we have to thank today?
Yeah, we got a couple we want to thank today. So first, I'd like to thank Kayla. Came in at our $3 level. Thank you so much, Kayla. We really, really appreciate it. And last, certainly not least, we have Sally. Also came in at our $3 level. So thank you so much, Sally.
Do you have numbers to know how close we are to 100 today?
The last time I looked, we were back down to 95. So we keep creeping up there almost to 100 and then creeping back down too. So
let's get there. It's almost the holidays. We can take some time off work during the holidays and call people.
I feel bad for our folks that have been sticking around with us for a long time. So I don't know. I might have a conversation with you off the air about just caving and going ahead and starting to call people. But we'll figure that out, and as soon as we figure it out, we'll let you Patreon members know what's going on and how to do that.
Got a really interesting case today, something we haven't covered a lot of, which we did the David Koresh case, but we haven't covered a lot of cult cases.
This is a case that I've heard about basically my whole life, but didn't really know that much about. I don't think I wanted to know much about it because of how awful it is. And now that I do, I wish I could go back to my ignorance because it is brutal and awful, and but also very interesting to talk about.
It really is. We're going to talk about Jonestown and the Jonestown murders that happened in Guyana.
Talking about the famous "Don't Drink the Kool-Aid" case, right?
Yeah. So. Which I knew where that had come from. That it came from a group of people that had done this. In the back of my mind, I always assumed that was the Heaven's Gate thing.
That's another famous cult that committed suicide together, and the images of that were on TV, like the bodies laying in their bunk beds with the black track suits on and their Nike shoes and the black veils over their face.
Yep.
That was like a horrifying image of my childhood that I'll never forget. But that is not this case.
And before that one, we had Jonestown.
So, yeah, I knew that it was a mass suicide, but I don't think I realized the numbers involved. So, look, why don't you get us rolling?
Sure. We're going to talk about Jim Jones, who is the founder of everything we're going to talk about today. In 1995, he established a religious movement. It started in Indianapolis, Indiana, and he called it the People's Temple. Now, it was spiritual. He, at this time, would preach from the Bible, but it was also very political, I guess. He pushed very socialist, progressive ideals. He did integrate racially before a lot of other churches did. And because of that, it was pretty unpopular in Indianapolis. So after a few years, he would relocate to California, and eventually he's going to leave the United States entirely, right?
Yeah.
In the summer of 1997, he had gotten a lot of negative publicity about the temple in the United States. It was being portrayed as a cult, which ultimately is what it was. So that's when he relocated the movement to Guyana. In South America. That's a country right next to Venezuela. I remember at some point in my childhood, I memorized the map of South America. Don't have that anymore in my head. Do you?
I don't have that. I had to memorize the entire periodic table of elements one time. I could never, I don't think I could give 10 of them in their right spots right now.
Agreed. I mean, I couldn't either. I'm not saying that you
couldn't. I feel you.
So when they got to Guyana, he set up a community. He kept the name the People's Temple, and he named the settlement where they lived Jonestown. At its peak, John, nearly 1,000 people lived there. Like you mentioned the numbers. When I think of this, I think of a room full of people, like 100, maybe two. There's a lot of people involved here. Reports started getting out of the camp that the conditions were poor and that some relatives of people that lived there started calling congressmen and complaining that there were people there that weren't being treated fairly, that wanted out but were essentially being held captive. It was then that Reverend Leo Ryan of California visited the settlement. It was a really high publicized event. He went there to check on the conditions in Jonestown and the welfare of the residents there. Now, what would follow after that visit would be a mass murder suicide where the representative was assassinated. Nearly 1,000 people were poisoned, and it was just a massacre, John. And before we get into the details of that, let's go back and talk about Jim Jones's background.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So we'll start at the top. He was born 1931 in Indiana. He spent his childhood growing up in Indiana. He grew up in a very poor household during the Great Depression. I mean, you know, if you look back on American history, this would be one of the worst times to grow up in. Nobody had jobs. Everybody was struggling. You know, not a great time to grow up. People didn't have anything, and they were oftentimes hungry. You know, families couldn't provide food for themselves. It was just a really bad time. As a child, it said that he just really gravitated towards religion and history. And I got a couple of stories about the religion part of it. It said that he really struggled making friends, really struggled having a good relationship with his parents. And at one time he had an encounter with a priest or some kind of, you know, religious figure, and said that this guy just showed, he almost had like a reverence about him. Like he was a very interesting person. People respected him. So he was really bought into that idea of being kind of a priest or kind of an authority figure within the church. I also heard stories about him, killing animals or killing birds and maybe even a cat in his home, and he would provide a funeral service for them so he could be the pastor in charge of that service. So he was really fascinated with being kind of a religious authority figure, which manifests itself later into what we're going to be talking about, right? He also loved history. It said that he studied the works of Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Gandhi. You know, not all of those folks are the greatest people to study and to really look up to. He would make notes on all of these people's strengths and weaknesses. So you just think of little Jim looking up to these people, and he's actually taking the time to make notes about some of their strengths, some of their weaknesses. It's kind of an odd thing to study, in my opinion. Neighbors and Jones himself indicated that Jones' father was involved in the Ku Klux Klan. A lot of times in the South, that's called the KKK. And that's a group of people who are just extremely racist. And so his father may have been involved in that. And he and Jones frequently argued over race relations. And according to Jim, he and his father went years without speaking after the elder refused to let one of Jones's friends, who happened to be African American, in the house. So just his dad seems like a very rigid, stern, close-minded man, very racist. And he and his dad just never really had a great relationship. Now, in 1949, Jim would marry his wife, Marceline, and they eventually earned a college degree in teaching in 1961.
Well, back in 1951, John, is when Jim Jones started attending Communist Party meetings. He started getting upset about the Red Scare, about communists being persecuted in the United States. He was very outspoken against segregation, and that wasn't a really popular take really anywhere in America at that time, but it certainly wasn't in Indianapolis. Like I said, that this was around the time that a local Methodist pastor had brought Jones in to be a student pastor at a church there. But the more he was there, the more he was around these traditional churches, he became more and more radical in his religious views. He particularly blamed the Methodist Church for helping and promoting segregation. So he didn't love his time there, and that's when, like I mentioned earlier, he started his own church. It was labeled as a Christian church that was full gospel. He established it as being open to all races, and in fact, he not only made his church interracial, John, he made his home interracial. In the early 1960s, he and his wife adopted several non-white children, and he would call this his rainbow family. So it's like he was doing this with what seemed like a genuine desire to integrate people and to let everyone live together, but he's going so far as to publicize what he's doing in his own home, which I think is an interesting conflict there. He eventually relocated the church to California. It's much more, was then and is now, progressive in their views. It was much more supportive of interracial worship. But even there, like I said, he got some negative media attention. There was a particular article in the New West magazine where former members of People's Temple talked about being physically, emotionally, and sexually abused. There was also a lot of manipulation involved, John. There was a time when Jim Jones himself faked getting shot and dying and then walked back out on stage a few days later proclaiming that he had come back from the dead, which he tried to pull the wool over his followers' masks all the time. It's said that he would have dinner with a member of the congregation, and then the next morning they would fall asleep with like a cast on their foot or a cast on their hand. When asked what happened, they would be told, "Don't you remember you broke your foot last night?" And then at the next church service, Jim Jones would quote unquote heal the broken foot or the broken hand. He had people that would go through his church members' garbage looking for ailments, looking for things going on that he could bring up on stage to look like a prophet and look like a miracle worker. He even tested his suicide method at one point, John. He asked every member of his church to drink grape Kool-Aid and told them that it was poisoned and that it was going to kill them. And you can find audio of this where he asks them to drink it and then they're all kind of upset. They're crying. They think they're dying. And he says, "This was a test of loyalty. And congratulations, you all passed." How crazy is that?
Yeah, I mean, he's just doing a lot of mind games, right? Like, you mentioned the fake shooting that he staged, right? I heard that he actually took the shirt that he was wearing from that day that was covered in blood and actually hung it up in the compound so that people could see it all the time. And it was like a testimony to the miracle that had happened of his life being spared, right? So just a really crazy guy. So when they got to Guyana, he started building this compound, and it was meant to be a social paradise, and Jones wanted it to be a communist community that promoted equality. However, Jones would not allow members to leave Jonestown. Now, Jamie, 68% of the Jonestown residents were African Americans, and they were attracted to the racial equality that they found while they were there. After the members moved to Jonestown, a previously hidden drug addiction of Jones became very clear to members. Do you happen to know what kind of drugs he was on?
It was heroin and cocaine. Like, he was really into the hard drugs, and somehow he kept this from his followers for a long time. And he was heavily addicted to these things and would use the money that he got from church members to fulfill those addictions. Let's take a quick break and we'll come right back and dig a little deeper. I'm going to tell you once again about another podcast that's brought to you by Wondery. This one's called Detective Trap. And it's a story about, in Santa Ana, California, three women disappear without a trace. And an unsuspected detective comes on the scene to seek justice for those that are missing.
So Jalissa Trap always wanted to be a cop. And now she is. She's a detective. But she's not like any other cop right now. She's the only woman in an otherwise all-male homicide squad, but she does her job in some ways that are kind of unconventional.
In this new podcast from Wondery, they partner with the Los Angeles Times. Again, it's called Detective Trap. That takes you into the life of this cop, Julissa Trap, who relentlessly pursues justice. It's hosted by award-winning journalist Chris Gofford, and it's the story of Detective Trap, who fights through her own personal struggles and society's indifference to her role to capture the serial killer and solve the mystery of these missing girls. But her strongest resource for catching all these criminals really comes from her own personal experience.
So make sure to go over and subscribe to Detective Trap. It's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to the podcast right now. You can also find the link in the episode notes below.
We're back, and now we'll get back into the case.
It was also at this time that Jones also began promoting a belief called translation. And that was the belief that Jones and all of his followers would die together and move into another planet to live in paradise together. I mean, we're talking about hundreds, like almost 1,000 people. How insane is it that you could get that many people to buy into this belief? Does that sound absurd to you?
It does. And let me say, not to fully promote other podcasts without their permission, but there's a podcast about Heaven's Gate where they really go into the psychology of getting people to follow cults in that way and just how you get that manipulative power over them. And at some point it becomes their internal almost prison of they can't get out of the groupthink of being in a situation like this.
Yeah, I mean, I know it happened, and I know that it's a real thing, but it just seems absolutely crazy to me that you can get that many people to follow you on such an absurd idea. But it happened, and hundreds, almost 1,000 lives lost because of this idea. Something else really disturbing that was happening in the compound was Jones's sexual abuse. Even though he was married, he would frequently sleep with members of the compound. He would convince people that it was a privilege and an honor to sleep with him. And so he would sleep with a lot of people that way. He would sexually abuse male, female. It didn't really matter to him. He convinced everybody in the compound that he was the only heterosexual male within the compound. There are some awful stories of his sexual abuse. I remember one where he was sexually abusing a minor in front of her father. Her father wanted it to happen because he felt like it was a privilege for his daughter to be with this man. So, I mean, just the amount of sickness involved with this guy, and that he was convincing everybody else around him that all of these awful things are okay, again, just kind of baffles me.
It does. And unfortunately or fortunately, I don't really know, there's so much audio that you can find from Jonestown. There are times when, as we mentioned earlier, his religious views became very radical. And by the end in Jonestown, he was trashing the Bible and talking about how it was brainwashing and teaching against a lot of what the Bible had to say. And you can also find clips where he's just up on stage yelling and cussing at people and asking individual young people if they wanted to have sex with each other and challenging them. First of all, if you can't stop, then you need to just do it and tell everybody that you like really public humiliation in really, really vulgar ways. So it went from manipulation to public, very public physical, sexual, and psychological abuse. And in 1977, one of the leaders in the temple had actually had enough of this when Jones directly interfered with his family. He had his attorney named John Stone. Jones had apparently impregnated Stone's wife, even though Stone was listed as the father on the birth certificate. Stone and his wife left the compound, but the child, because Jones claimed it, stayed in Jonestown in South America. Stone came back to the United States. He formed a group called Concerned Relatives, a bunch of people who had relatives living in Jonestown that were worried about them. And they started pressuring Congress to do something. They would write letters. They would call congressmen. They were really worried about their loved ones. I mentioned his name earlier, Representative Leo Ryan, who is a Democrat, is one of the ones who finally showed interest in what he was hearing. And he wrote a letter on Stone's behalf to the Prime Minister of Guyana. They were trying to start a legal battle to get the child of Stone's wife and Jim Jones back and get custody in the United States. It was in June of 1978 that there was another escaped member named Deborah Layton swore an affidavit that there was significant abuse happening at Jonestown. This is a legal document swearing that she had seen this abuse and that something needed to be done.
In November of 1978, Representative Ryan would actually go to Jonestown kind of on a fact-finding mission to see if there was actually abuses going on and if human rights were being violated. So he took Temple relatives. He also took an NBC crew and several newspaper reporters. So this is quite the entourage going down to Guyana to figure out what's going on there. So after landing, Ryan and his delegates were holed up in the capital of Georgetown for several days because Jones refused to permit them to enter the grounds at Jonestown. Nevertheless, the entourage flew to an airstrip outside of Jonestown, and Jones tried to keep them from entering, but ultimately he allowed them in and kind of welcomed them. There was a big reception to honor them, and that was held on November 17th. The day that they was the first day that they entered the settlement. Now, before all this happened, I remember stories of Jim Jones talking to his people, I'm going to say his congregation, about this visit, and that they weren't allowed to say anything that would, you know, come across as being negative about the compound. He wanted them to be happy and to smile and to say good things. So he was kind of brainwashing them into how they needed to handle this visit by all of these people. But within hours of being on the compound, there's an NBC correspondent who's walking around with Representative Ryan, and somebody from the compound hands him a note. And that note said, "Please help get me out of Jonestown." And I think that they thought that he was Representative Ryan, but nonetheless, it got into the hands of somebody who needed to see the note.
The very next morning, Ryan and his group continued to interview people and to find out if they felt like they were being held against their will or if they saw what was happening there as abuse. And as part of those interviews, there was a woman that secretly told Ryan and his people that she wanted to leave and that her family and another family had planned on doing so as soon as they could. Around 3 p.m. that day, there was all the media groups that John mentioned, along with 14 Temple defectors. They got on a truck and were going to the airstrip to get on the plane that Representative Ryan had flown in on. They were joined there by Temple member Larry Layton, who was pretending to be a defector. So he had been planted there by Jim Jones, pretending to be somebody that wanted to leave but didn't really want to. At this time, Representative Ryan was still in Jonestown, hoping to find other people who wanted to go back home to the United States. Shortly after this group had left for the airstrip, Temple member Don Sly attempted to attack Representative Ryan with a knife. That attack failed. The security with him were able to keep the attacker away. But for Ryan, I guess that was his time to know that I don't need to stay here and keep looking. My safety is in danger. I need to leave Jonestown, although he did say he would come back at a later time. At around 4:45 p.m., Ryan and his group got to the airport, and they were going to wait about 30 minutes for the planes to come. After the planes arrived, Larry Layton, who was again posing as a defector, opened fire on the five other passengers on his particular plane. He wounded several of them. And at the same time, Temple members that surrounded the airstrip opened fire on both planes. That attack killed Representative Ryan, three journalists, and one of the defectors. It also wounded nine other people, including Ryan's chief aide, Jackie Speer, who would go on later to become a congresswoman. Unwounded passengers were able to subdue Larry Layton and to stop the shooting. And the survivors of this attack fled into the surrounding fields. It took several hours for them to be rescued by other security that was around. And most of them ended up spending the night in a local cafe there waiting to be rescued and flown back to the United States.
So it's later on this same day that 909 people from Jonestown would either be murdered or commit suicide. And I mean, that is just such an insane number. I mean, I don't think there's anything like that in our American history other than the terrorist attacks on 9/11 that would equal that many lives, right? I mean, that is just a crazy number when you think about it.
It really is, and especially for suicide to be a big part of this, which we could get into a psychological conversation about whether they had control over taking their own lives or not. But a lot of these people did drink the poison on their own volition.
Yeah. So of that 909 people, 304 were children. So, you know, these kids didn't have a choice. I mean, they were told to drink this stuff. So, I mean, again, this is one of the most crazy things that I've ever heard of. And we've been doing true crime research and work for, 2 years now? This is the craziest thing I've ever seen. So the FBI would later recover a 45-minute audio recording of the mass suicide and homicides that took place. And we're going to let you listen to a little bit of that right now, but I want to just talk a little bit about what you're going to hear on there. First off, I need to mention that the Kool-Aid was poisoned with cyanide. So all these folks died of cyanide poisoning. And that is not a pleasant way to die. It is a very painful and excruciating way to die. It's rather quick in the scheme of things, right? But very painful.
It's very agonizing. And they did put some sedatives in there to try to calm people down, but that certainly did not alleviate the pain and agony that these families felt as they were dying.
We'll give you a little bit of a warning before we start playing this audio, because some of you folks may not want to hear this. There's some parts that, you know, you might get a little freaked out by. So anyway, we'll let you know. But on the tape, you're going to hear Jones tell Temple members that the Soviet Union, which he had previously claimed was negotiating with Jonestown for a mass exodus, would not take them after the attacks that happened on Representative Ryan. He told them that they had to commit suicide because CIA officers would soon parachute in here on us and shoot our innocent babies for what happened there, and that they would also torture their children and the seniors that were in Jonestown. There was a lot of stuff that he would say to kind of convince these people to drink that. So why don't we go ahead and play that audio now?
To me, death is not a fearful thing. It's living that's treacherous. I have never, 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 never seen anything like this before in my life. I've never seen people take the law and do in their own hands and provoke us and try to purposefully agitate murder of children. Christine, it's not worth living like this. I want your life in my hand, but I'm going to tell you, Christine, without me, life has no meaning. I'm the best friend you'll ever have. Once I have to pay, I'm standing with you, Jara. I'm standing with those people. They're part of me. I can detach myself. My attorney says detach myself. No, 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 no. I never detached myself from any of your troubles. I've always taken your troubles right on my shoulders. And I'm not going to change that now. It's too late. I've been running too long. I'm not going to change now. Maybe the next time you get to go to Russia, the next time around. This is what I'm talking about now is in the dispensation of judgment. This is a revolutionary suicide council. Please get us some medication. It's simple. It's simple. There's no convulsions with it. It's just simple. Just please get it. Before it's too late, the GDF will be here. I tell you, get moving. Get moving. Get moving. Don't be afraid to die. If these people land out here, they'll torture some of our children here. They'll torture our people. They'll torture our seniors. We cannot have this. Are you going to separate yourself from whoever shot the congressman? I don't know who shot him. We're trying. Everybody will relax. The best thing you do to relax, and you'll have no problem. You'll have no problem with the thing if you just relax.
The children here a great deal because of Jim Jones. And the way the children are laying there now, I'd rather see them lay like that than to see them have to die like the Jews did, which was pitiful anyhow. take our life from us. We laid it down. We got tired. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world.
As you can hear, he's on tape preaching to these people to drink this Kool-Aid, and he continues to talk as they're drinking it. And you can unfortunately hear them screaming in the background. And I don't know if he's trying to be a calming presence or just maintain control, but he just continues talking to these people while he watches them die. The children would be given the drink by their parents, and then families would lie down in the same area and die together. Anybody who was not willing to drink the Kool-Aid was forced to. He had tried to prepare his community for this for months. He talked about it often. Like I said earlier, he simulated it to test their loyalty to him. And he often talked to them about, this is what we're going to do. There was even a remote site where they did a lot of shipping from that was several miles from the camp. And they communicated the message of, it's time for everybody to commit suicide. And they relayed back and forth and said, we don't have any of the Kool-Aid here. So what happened was, this one lady went into a bathroom with her kids, used a knife to cut their throats, and then slit her own wrist to die just because she got the message from Jonestown that this was happening. Even if it had not been happening, they could have lied to her and she could have done this.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that, again, kind of what I was going into as far as the psychological component? I mean, she didn't know for sure if this was happening. They could have completely lied to her, like the time he told them to drink the grape Kool-Aid and there was nothing in it. I mean, you know, she was just completely bought into everything he was selling.
Because that had been going on for years, and he had been preaching the same messages, and he had been showing them all these miracles that he was making up, and they really trusted everything he had to say. And we see that in a lot of cults, right, that the people at times are blindly following. They choose to follow, but then once they do, they follow at all costs, and it costs almost 1,000 people in Jonestown their lives.
Jones himself was later found dead on the floor with a gunshot wound to the head. Now, of course, this gunshot wound was consistent with suicide. And Jones also was found later to have high levels of drugs in his system, Jamie mentioned earlier. Above the chair in which he had shot himself, there was a sign that read, "Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it." And that's a saying that a lot of folks say all the time. I'm not smart enough to know the origins of that saying. I don't know if you happen to know off the top of your head.
No idea.
But obviously somebody, I think, has said that before. It's quoted all the time. There were only a few survivors of this massacre. Among them were Jones' sons. There were Stephen, Jim Jr., and Tim. They weren't at the compound that day because they were playing basketball in the capital city. So they weren't around for the time of the murder and suicides. Additionally, there were three high-ranking temple members who were off the compound on assignments, and therefore they escaped. So between the airstrip shootings and the Jonestown deaths, 914 people lost their lives because of Jim Jones. Today, that compound still stands, although it's, of course, been looted and vandalized. It's still there. There was only one time briefly in the 1980s that something else was in this compound. But other than that, it's been vacant all this time, just because no one wants to go in to this place and have any kind of business there. I honestly can't believe it's not been torn down. I can't believe that it still remains today. But nonetheless, that's where we are. And as I mentioned earlier, up until 9/11, this was the most American lives lost at one time. So just insane that one man could have so much power over so many people.
And, you know, it seemed to start, I mean, with him, with the good ideas, right? He was trying to get people to love each other regardless of how they looked. He was trying to use religion to bring people together. But it seemed as if time went on, he continued to enjoy the power. And it said that he often would fear people turning away from him. And it wasn't just that he was afraid of getting arrested or getting in trouble for what was going on in Georgetown. just people turning their backs on him was an idea that he could not cope with, and that's why he had complete control over everything happening in Jonestown.
Yeah, I've kind of wondered just in my own mind, like, did he have other people in the compound helping him in any way, or was this all kind of his mastermind and he was the only one helping to influence all these people?
I'm glad you brought that up. He did have a group of leadership around him, so it's almost like a council that he would go to with ideas and they would help him execute his plans. And I wonder, like, it's one thing, like, I guess you have your cult leader who is giving all these ideas to this group, and this group is blindly following. But what about those middle people, the people that actually have a say to the cult leader to, I guess, help to influence what happens? I wonder what kind of position that puts them in when, what if they didn't agree with the mass suicide? What if they weren't on board? As Mr. Stone, we mentioned earlier, he was one of the leaders before Jim Jones slept with his wife and had a baby. I wonder how it's different for them having a higher role in it, because those were the people going through the trash and helping to plan out the fake miracles and helping to provide evidence to support all these conspiracies that Jim Jones was telling everybody. But yet there was a leadership group, but I don't know how they functioned versus the rest of the group where they just blindly followed.
Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting to figure out more of their backstory like we have on Jones. Like, what in their past led them to be able to be so easily swayed by this guy? It's awful and it's tragic that so many lives were lost. But at the same time, for me, and this might sound weird, it's just oddly fascinating, psychologically speaking, of how one man and this team of people could convince 900 people to commit suicide and to murder their children, essentially. So anyway, I'm kind of glad this one's behind us.
Yeah, you're right. It's something you don't want to hear, but the psychological piece of it is just so intriguing. And you just wonder how and why something like that can happen. And it still happens today. There are still cults that exist. We've certainly not had a mass suicide to this degree, but it has happened. And yeah, I'm with you. We're done.
Yeah, I think if we ever do another cult mass suicide, we're going to have to do the Heaven's Gates people. I mean, that was one, that, like I said, from my childhood that almost traumatized me seeing the images of that on TV. So, yeah, with that being said, I'm glad this one's done.
Yep. Thank you guys for, as always, for spending this time with us and talking about this horrifying yet interesting story. And again, thanks to the Patreon members. If you are interested in that, you do get rewards for being on Patreon. You get bonus episodes. You can get signed autographs. You can get coffee mugs. You can select cases for us. There are a lot of different things you can do on Patreon.
So, Jamie, our Patreon is awesome, and I'm glad people are doing that. But we have another kind of announcement that's going to be a really awesome way for you to get involved with making the holidays even more incredible for some folks who desperately need it. So why don't you tell them about what we're doing now?
Yeah, I think we've talked about it on our other podcast, but John's family and my family, through an organization that my wife and I founded, provide a Christmas party to a group home of boys in Eastern Kentucky. And these are boys who can't be in foster care for whatever reason, but they are in this home together. And we, for the last few years, have bought them Christmas gifts. Now, there are other people, there's a party and other people are there doing things too, but we really try to make this holiday season away from their family, living in this home, as wonderful as it can be. And we're going to raise money for that via True Crime Cast. We're going to, all of our t-shirt profits are going to go toward this cause. We are going to set up an auction site where we're going to auction off some items that we've signed. Like we did for Patreon, we did a video Q&A, and we had kind of a background of all kinds of different sketches and pictures from our pasts and pictures from crimes and those kinds of things. We're signing that. We're going to auction those off. We're going to be selling signed photographs, signed, I guess, mini posters of True Crime Cast. So we're going to be auctioning off and selling a bunch of stuff, and all the money is going to go toward this Christmas project.
Yeah, we're so incredibly thankful for everything you all do to support Jamie and I, but this is an opportunity to do something much bigger than that. we get to personally see the boys' faces when they receive these gifts. And these boys live there. They don't have families that they get to run to a Christmas tree and get gifts. So this is their Christmas. And so you guys, if you are able to financially contribute to this, are doing some awesome things. You guys get to help make the holidays for what would otherwise be a pretty sad and lonely time become something special for these kids. So be looking for that website. We're going to post those here pretty soon and give you a chance to contribute to their Christmases this year.
And every little bit helps, even if you just wanted to donate. We've done everything from buying them T-shirts. Last year, somebody donated a flat-screen TV to go and put in their common area. So every little bit goes to contribute to the group gifts, but also we give a lot of individual things. So anything helps.
Yep. So we look forward to working with you all to make this happen, and we're excited to see what happens with this. I mean, look, this could fail. Nobody could contribute, but I have faith in our listeners that you guys are going to help make the Christmases for these boys in Eastern Kentucky one to remember. So we thank you in advance, and we look forward to seeing what you guys do.
Yep, guys, we really appreciate that. Just be looking for those links on our True Crime Cast Twitter and Facebook pages, and that's where you'll be able to find it. And we'll be back with another case next week.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.